Mormon Mental Health Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations are tax deductible and go directly to the costs associated with podcast production. Donations may also go towards research, material development, and counseling costs for those who can't afford them. The goals of this podcast include education, advocacy, and the promotion of health and general well-being for Mormons and their families. To support the podcast and its efforts, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. Thank you for listening. One of the things that I want to make sure that we cover, we've probably covered this on a lot of different bases already, but you know, let's talk a little bit about the basic structure of how missions are structured. To be redundant there, and some of the pitfalls that maybe come from that. So I mean, I think we've talked a little bit about expectations and black and white thinking and, you know, equational approaches. But are there more specifics that either one of you would want to address as far as mission structure?
Well, I hope that Daniel will mention you in when we were exchanging email before all of this or messages. The thing you wrote about how weird it is that you're asked to not think about home, because I have more to say about that. So if you'll start with that, I can follow up.
Yeah, well, I mean, so essentially right from the get-go, you know, you're called to serve and you leave. And there's this huge wave of really disenfranchised grief. You lose access to your loved ones, you lose access, immediate access to your support system, and as well, you're cut off by and large from almost every meaningful coping mechanism that you engaged in. Certainly when I went on my mission, I found great relief and reprieve in studying the scriptures. However, when that was all that I had, it became wholly insufficient. And so then you go from there to being surrounded by a very hierarchical system where you've got, you know, your mission president who reports to church headquarters or the regional authority. And then from there, you know, going down to basically young men who are ruling young men. Another one of my good friends was talking about his mission experience and how strange it was that he, as a missionary, really revered and feared one of his zone leaders, who just seemed like he was always on the ball, but he was also very kind of hard-nosed. And then, you know, he gets home from his, my friend gets home from his mission and years later runs into this guy and his life's kind of a wreck. And my friend just kind of thought, wow, it's so crazy how much stock I put into what this guy thought of me. And at the end of the day, you know, he was just another 20-year-old kid. But structurally, he had authority to tell me what I should and shouldn't think about the work that I did and how hard I worked and whether or not it was good enough. So I don't know if that kind of addresses what you wanted to go into, Natasha, but I do think that that hierarchy of calling is a force multiplier in, you know, that some of the thinking errors that we talked about, the black and white thinking and the idealization and the magical thinking about if you're just righteous enough, then you'll have no limitations to your work ability.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And I think one of the things that I noticed is I was asked to give, a fireside or something along those lines to missionaries. This was probably about almost 2 years ago now, I'm guessing. It was right after kind of the shift of the age difference had happened. And one thing that it made me think about, because they had me come in and talk about depression, specifically to the sister missionaries, and they were having quite a bit of issue with that. And I think, first of all, even though there was great hoopla about the age difference, and I think a lot of women in particular were very excited that, you know, this opportunity would be given to them at an earlier age, like the young men, which I think is great. At the same time, there was really very little adjustment in that preparation for those sisters who were caught in that 1 to 2 year shift of life planning, in a sense, right? So, you know, I have this idea that I might go when I'm 21, and now all of a sudden the option's there for me to go tomorrow, right? And so that even though a lot of people jumped on that bandwagon and that was a lot of excitement going on, I think there were some repercussions that were not thought through as far as I wasn't really planning on this, and now I'm finding myself out here. So I think that's one thing that I noticed. And also for the young men now that go at 18, I see real problems with that from this grief perspective of family and resources, in the sense that this is going to be their first experience away from home. Mm-hmm. And it's a dramatic one. You know, whereas before they had a year to maybe go to college where they were gone for 4 months, or maybe they were going to work, or they were going to try something out, you know, in their home environment that wasn't as drastic of a flying out of the nest type of scenario, if that makes sense. And mm-hmm. so now, you know, they go straight from a very structured, you know, usually Mormon families in particular have very structured home environments, lots of support, lots of love, to, you know, you're completely torn away from that in pretty drastic ways. You know, you can only contact your family twice a year, as far as, you know, with phone calls and things of that nature. You can write obviously more often than that, but it's a huge difference. Yeah. And there's been no practice at leaving home. And now you're leaving home for 2 years, you know, for a long time. So I think that has also created some issues that we hadn't been used to seeing before, and just the non-preparation. Plus, from a mental health perspective, we know that the serious types of mental health disorders, such as schizophrenia or even bipolar, or, you know, things that can really affect people's lives, tend to develop right around the time that you leave home for the first time. And yeah. So that can be very, you know, confusing and traumatic for people in those types of situations as well, that don't understand why, you know, the shift is so difficult to adjust to.
Yeah.
I would agree with all of that. And I would, in terms of what Daniel first brought up, that was my first big awakening at the MTC, was when someone said, put out of your mind all thoughts of family, friends, home, school. And I don't know why I hadn't anticipated that. I don't know why I hadn't. But my reaction was, why on earth would I want to put out of my mind thoughts of those things? Those are precisely the things that made a mission seem desirable and meaningful. Why would you want me to stop thinking about the things that matter most to me and are the real reason I'm here?
Yeah.
And it was really traumatic and upsetting. And I felt that basically the church was taking my mind away from me. They were taking my interior life away from me. And I really resented it. And, you know, and in terms of feeling, I mean, I had already gone to 4 years of college when I went on my mission. I had mastered a foreign language. Well, mastered. I was pretty darn good at a foreign language. I'd lived by myself. I managed to get myself from London to Athens on my own. And all of a sudden, I'm having 19-year-old boys tell me when I have to go to bed. And boy, oh boy, that was a trauma to have these silly little men tell me, you know, Sister Welker, you can't go. It's too late for you to go do this or that. Excuse me? I can, you know, I mean, guys who'd never left Utah telling me what I could and couldn't do. And oh, that, well, my nickname
it doesn't respect your adult womanhood. No. No, it doesn't, it doesn't respect the developmental life cycle that you're on.
No. And my nickname in the MTC was Sister Reddy, after Helen Reddy of I Am Woman fame. The elders, they all thought it was so funny that I was, that I actually cared about women. It was a joke in the MTC. And that was just yet another thing that made it that, all the preparation, all the development, all the things I had done that would have made me a good missionary were trivialized. within a day of my getting there.
Yeah. I really want to highlight that and acknowledge that, you know, when these young men and women go out to serve, there's a fundamental shift that occurs in their relationship to the gospel and to the church. You know, I went in to serve a mission because I had a very deep personal connection with my Heavenly Father. And I felt very spiritually moved. And here Holly's discussing all of the aspects of her faith and culture that were meaningful to her. And suddenly, instead of being something that is personal and meaningful, you get shifted into being, you know, a sales rep. And this thing which previously serviced you and your needs and your identity was now demanding a lot from you, demanding probably more from you than anything has demanded of you in your life up to that point. And it's like the analogy that I enjoy, because I underwent this as well, is, you know, everybody loves timeshares. You go and use a timeshare and you have a wonderful vacation, and it costs half as much because you've already been paying half of your money on it for the first year anyway. But there's a big difference between enjoying a timeshare and going to Disneyland and selling timeshares. And so the church and the gospel and the purpose and meaning that it brings into your life, it really gets shifted. And you have these authorities telling you, don't think about your family, as Holly noted. Don't think about, you know, home. And it's dangerous, I think.
Don't think. I got in trouble. You know, I got in really big trouble in the MTC when we were discussing The Fall for mentioning Paradise Lost by John Milton. You know, my teacher flipped out and said, there is no room in this classroom for secular writers' ideas on sacred topics. I mean, it's freaking John Milton. I was just like, oh my gosh, you're an idiot. You're teaching me. And it's just, it was really, it was just, and of course you can't say that. You can't challenge the authority. Yeah. You can't. Even though I did over and over and over.
which kind of comes back to the potential for ecclesiastical abuse. And we've mentioned, you know, the potential for that, but I would like to spend a few minutes on that. When you have a system where the buck stops, you know, at certain levels of leadership authority, and there's really no ability to kind of go beyond that or to say, hey, I don't think I'm being treated correctly, or there's no like second check system in a sense. Can either of you speak to that potential?
I'm sure we both could. Holly, I'd love to hear your thoughts though, to start off.
Well, again, this is one of those things where I was lucky in that everybody with whom the buck stopped was someone who trusted and respected me, both my mission presidents. Even at the MTC, I ended up, this teacher, I ended up in a very serious conflict with him. I reported him. I was encouraged to write a complaint about him. He didn't like women. But it can happen. Even in, the thing is, you know, you can only see your mission president every so often, and you can have a bad companion. A bad senior companion can really do awful things to a person.
Yeah. Yeah. You know. I think, Natasha, it goes back to what you had just mentioned. Excuse me, about that there's no check or balance system, because that's just not the way the church works. And so why would missions work that way, I guess? You know, I also was very fortunate to have a mission president who was great. Not to say that he never lost his temper with us as missionaries and never expressed disappointment, but by and large, he was very intelligent, level-headed, encouraging. And honestly, I had heroified the man. He was everything to me as a missionary, which, real quick side note, is I think another aspect of potential trauma is that here I, in the absence of all meaningful attachments in my life, I had placed my mission president in such high regard that, I mean, if he looked at me wrong, my world was destroyed. So then you add on top of that that yeah, there's tremendous opportunity for abuse of authority, whether it's intentional or not. You know, I would venture to say that there aren't very many, if any, young men serving as district leaders and zone leaders who got called to it and thought, you know what I want to do? I want to throw my weight around and feel powerful, even if that is a motive going on somewhere in their psyche. But it's still, there's no check and balance. And so here you are, this missionary, and it's your job to take the feedback of your leader and to say, okay, yeah, I'll try harder. And then when things go wrong, it gets all the worse.
Especially in terms of listening to the Sick RMs podcast, which actually was so upsetting for me. It really did. It triggered my PTSD. I had to stop at one point. It took me a while to get through it. So we really are talking about genuine trauma. It's been 30 years and I can still be so upset, by some of these things that, it's hard for me to hear about them. But they said some things that were meaningful that I want to repeat here. One, they mentioned the pressure to not discuss anything negative in your letters home, even in your journals. Don't say anything negative. Now, I just ignored that. I remember a GA coming to his own conference and saying that and just thinking, I'm going to write whatever I want. Mm-hmm. But that is a place where there could be a meaningful intervention and dialogue and discourse where missionaries could say, you know, this is what's going on. And parents could say, wait a minute, honey. Let's think this through. But since they're encouraged not to, that's really a problem. And missionaries should be encouraged to be honest. There needs to be honesty and candor between missionaries and their parents. They should be allowed to confide in them. Maybe they'll want to paint the rosy view for their friends, their siblings, but they should be allowed to be honest with their parents. And then the other thing is somebody mentioned, it might have been you, Natasha, if you went to a mental health professional and said, I'm having these really unpleasant experiences. I'm in this system where I work 10 to 14 hours a day with one person every day. I'm not allowed to have contact with my family. I can't even use my real name. I can't read newspapers. What would they say to you?
Yeah, it doesn't sound very healthy.
And yeah, you know. I mean,
yeah. Well, that's exactly right. That many of the things that we know, well, through mental health, but really even just through common sense, that are helpful things when we're struggling are disapproved of in the missionary setting, such as being in contact with a support network that can offer, you know, objective, or maybe not objective because family is not necessarily always objective, but can offer a different point of view or a different perspective. Giving yourself personal time, right? Giving yourself ability to distract or do a variety of things to help you cope with it. Just there's really no room for many of those things in the structure of missionary day-to-day life.
And when you think about it that way, it's honestly shocking that more missionaries aren't traumatized by their mission. There is a level of difficulty inherent in a mission that's just going to be hard. It's just going to be difficult. The difficulty of a mission is difficult, to be tautological. And since the stakes for failure are so high, finding it difficult feels like a condemnation.
Yeah.
In ways it doesn't when you're just in college. And this is something that is happening to very young people with few resources and a very malleable sense of self.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I just echo what I had mentioned earlier, that it seems to me, the more I talk to people about this, it's mission trauma is something everybody experiences, but nobody talks about. And it's mirrored in, you know, my work with compassion fatigue and vicarious trauma in healthcare providers, you know, physicians and nurses and medical assistants and other psychotherapists. There's this idea of everybody acknowledges it. They don't know what to do about it. And as you mentioned, Holly, the risk or the cost of failure is so high that you simply pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you go on and don't talk about it because that would somehow make it worse. And so I really appreciate opportunities like this where we can say, look, in order to address this properly, we've got to talk about it. We've got to shed some light.
Well, and one last thing I want to talk about in regards to these themes is kind of going back to what I call developmental tasks. You know, every single era or episode of life kind of has its own developmental task. You know, at 2 years old, you're supposed to start saying no and figure out that you're an independent person, that you're separate from your parents, right? And developmental tasks of, you know, 18 to 25 year olds really have to do with, you know, kind of finding your own voice, being able to, figure out, you know, where am I separate and different from, for example, the parental or communal structure I came from. I think a lot of those developmental tasks are about becoming adult, you know, so having adult boundaries and, like, to your example, Holly, where, you know, you're being told when to go to bed and things of that are actually very, childlike and adolescent type, actions of how to treat an adult person. So, in some ways, I see the mission experience stunting some of those developmental tasks. Of course, sexually, you know, we're supposed to be asexual beings when we're missionaries, so there's some developmental stunting there as well. And I think that just from a variety of things where I'm in a stage of my life where I'm supposed to kind of be exploring the world and figuring out who I am and what I believe and what these things mean to me, we're forcing instead this pushing into, this is where you are supposed to fit, this is what you're supposed to think, this is the structure you're supposed to follow, and if you don't fall in line, there is something inherently wrong with you, whereas truly the developmental task would be to rebel from that a little bit. And, yeah, you know, kind of like when Holly, you're saying, well, I just said, you know, the hell with that kind of a thing, you know, I'm not going to listen to that, you know, that advice. That was a normal developmental task that you were able to still do on your mission, right? So, but many people don't feel that freedom or feel guilty or feel shame if somehow they're not agreeing with everything that's being said. And again, we're rewarding those that aren't necessarily following through with those developmental tasks.
Well, the problem is stunted is a really good word. And I think that many of the missionaries I dealt with were stunted, and I was stunted. I was stunted. My approach to my developmental task was definitely stunted. And I was in this horrible catch-22 where there were so many things I heard that I just thought, that's nonsense. Mm-hmm. So I was able to do that, but because I was in this system where conformity was so valued, and because I was so far away from home, and because I had, you know, a traumatic brain injury, I simply came to believe that I was damned. That because I was unable to buy into all the things I was told, that I was so fundamentally repugnant to God. And there is a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins where he talks about my taste was me, self. Oh, I'd have to look it up. These six sonnets that Gerard Manley Hopkins wrote when he was in the grip of religious despair. And that's what happened to me. And I became, I don't even use the term depression. I experienced religious despair. I certainly was depressed. I could not sleep or eat. I could not digest food. And I had this really horrible coating on my tongue that I later learned was the result of not sleeping, not digesting food properly. All I knew was that I was revolting to myself. And I would constantly think of the scripture where God says that he will spew the lukewarm out of his mouth. And I experienced my own body as an index of my repugnance to God. And yet I didn't go home. That's the other thing. Like, I felt like this. I wanted to die. I was suicidally depressed as a missionary. I wanted to die. That's not even strong enough. I wanted to be eradicated. Death would not be good enough because I would still be pursued for all eternity by this deity who found me so lacking. Mm-hmm. And yet it never occurred to me to go home.
Yeah.
So, anyway. Well, and that, I mean, that in a sense just speaks to the cultural non-allowance of that option. I mean, it's not really an option. I mean, it's an option that's very, I mean, missionaries who are coming home early for whatever reason, whether it's health or quote unquote worthiness, that's a whole traumatic event of itself, right? Because it has meaning attached to it that we see that in a sense as a failure. It's kind of like,
yes, I was a horrible person and God hated me, but I was not going to be a quitter on top of it.
Yeah,
exactly. Right.
I developmental tasks, I think you both are right on par. The only thing I would add is that it is pretty impossible, I think, to really predict accurately what the impact will be, like system-wide, to suddenly drop this age so low. But my thought is that one of the themes that we're going to see increasing is that there's going to be a much larger spring back. So that is to say, you know, these missionaries who go out so young and lack so much integration of identity or ego strengths or capacity to resolve conflict and feel self-worth despite, feeling instances of failure. They're going to, I believe there's a risk of internalizing all of this. And then when they get home and process it to whatever degree, whether it's with a therapist or on their own, that the result is not going to be a keep quiet and just march on and don't acknowledge that my mission was traumatizing. Instead, it's going to be a violent departure from the faith. I'm not a prophet or a seer, but I do feel like that there is at least theoretical precedent for that to occur.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well,
there's also anecdotal. I know many of the people I talked to when I was collecting stories, yes, feel a great deal of bitterness and anger over the church's failure to help them and even let them be healthy and left very angry. And for that matter, you know, I mean, I managed to hang on for 3 years after my mission. I could not leave my mission was so awful. Leaving the church would have been, it would have meant that all of that pain and trauma was avoidable. And I simply couldn't do it. It took me three years before I finally left. But coming home was itself another trauma. And I believe that was one of the things you wanted to talk about, Natasha, is post-mission trauma and the fact that I just refused to shut up about what had happened to me, but nobody got it. Nobody understood it. and nowhere did anyone understand. Like, even within my major, I went back and I started taking creative writing classes again, and I would write these poems about these awful things that had happened to me, and people would actually say to me, they're like, what do you know about unhappiness? I know what it's like to feel down. Do you know that?
So. Yeah, there really is no support network necessarily. We just expect them to just jump right back into kind of normal LDS living and kind of continue on the timeline that's proposed, right? So then comes marriage and a baby carriage. So it's all laid out in a sense of what the expectations are coming home from a mission, and very little dialogue or support about just even the adjustment, even if you've had a positive missionary experience, just the adjustment of back into daily life and what that's like, and relating to people on kind of very different terms. I mean, people that you have to, in a sense, reconnect with, you haven't really had sincere contact with for a long time.
Yeah.
Getting used to using first names again. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
And just relating to people in an empathic way without a motive of, you know, getting them to do or be something. Yeah, something that I really enjoyed that Joanna Brooks said in an interview on NPR a while back, is she talked about how Mormons and Mormon culture have this overriding need to be useful. That we as people, we need to individually, that we just need to be useful. And I would say that that's really instilled on a mission. And you could take that as both a good and a bad. It's two sides of the coin. As I came home, that's all I could think of, is I need to be useful and contribute to society. And as soon as that happens, then I can get married. And it dominated my psychology so much that, I couldn't feel anything but anger or, fleeting moments of success, in attaining job interviews. And then the cycle would repeat and repeat and repeat. I had to be useful. Mm-hmm. And there was nowhere else to give me a reality check and say, look, you're a human being. Welcome back to connecting to human beings, because Adam and Eve weren't put here to be useful. They were put here to experience life.
Right. And then even the idea of being useful, that there's so many different ways to go about that that don't necessarily mean converting people to your way of thinking, right? So
yes,
just expanding the idea of how to be useful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I know that you had mentioned prior to our recording that you had six themes that mission trauma kind of, you wanted to make sure we covered. Have we covered those indirectly, or would you like to cover those more formally?
You know, I just looking at my notes here from our conversation, and I think we've really covered everything pretty well. Just very succinctly, the first thing that it really starts with that loss and disenfranchised grief. And from there, you get this fundamental shift in your relationship with God and your relationship with the church and the gospel. You're no longer there to be enriched. You're there to sell it. And then that's compounded by specific traumatic events or specific moments of disillusionment. Holly mentioned falling through her neighbor's kitchen roof, as well as disillusionment that, you know, the mission's not what you thought it would be. Your leaders aren't who they thought they were. From there, there's a little something I like to call trauma soup, which is this process of extreme idealization and devaluation, followed by a lot of powerlessness and shame, and then a lot of very primitive defense mechanisms that are reinforced by the whole mission. This magical thinking was mentioned. This idea of omnipotent control, that if I'm just righteous enough, that everything will go my way. A whole lot of denial. And then the last two really is that there's almost no room in a mission for acceptance of what is, followed by a compassionate view of the self and of others. I think missions could really benefit from incorporating mindfulness, a lot of mindfulness training. And then the last one is just that element of time. And as we had mentioned, that you're there for 18 months to 2 years. And so if you're not, if you don't feel that sense of identity slipping away, if you're not traumatized in some way in the first month or 2 months or 3 months, then surely something will have impacted you in that way by month 17, 18, 19, 20, et cetera.
Yeah. Okay, good.
That's a really great list. I would add one thing to it, though. When Daniel was mentioning you get out, you find a mission's not what you thought you were, your leaders aren't who you thought they were. For many, many, many people, I think there are probably some who don't do this either because they lack self-reflection or because they know themselves so well or whatever. But I think most people are going to get out and go, oh, I'm not who I thought I was.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're going to have a harder time with the rules than you expected. You're not going to be happy all the time. It's one of those things where you think, well, of course you're going to figure that out. But it's not part of the narrative, and you're young and foolish, and you're far from home. And it's hard. It's really hard to discover that you're not who you thought you were, and then to have really successful means to help you figure out who you then are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
And really, that's the pervasive backdrop of the whole mission experience, right? Even before the age was dropped down to 18 for young men, you know, identity is something that most of us are working on throughout the rest of our lives. So it's still pretty fresh for a 20, 21-year-old to really be figuring out and crystallizing who they are in the backdrop of everything else that's going on in a mission.
So I would like to move the conversation then to recommendations, suggestions, visions for hope, change, anything along those things. So why don't we start with what advice would we give to those preparing to go on missions? You know, we've talked a lot about the potential pitfalls and things that, you know, false expectations and things. What kinds of things could we, you know, help educate future missionaries to be prepared for?
You know, I think probably one of the most helpful things would be, and I don't know how feasible this is, but really removing the cultural just expectation that young men and increasingly that young women serve, and that instead it be placed as something that if it's meaningfully experienced and pursued by someone, then go for it. But I don't find much value in expecting everybody to go. And that's me as a psychotherapist talking. From there, I would immediately recommend that part of missionary training be acknowledging, acceptance of what we can't control. And like I mentioned, mindfulness training, because there needs to be more reality, I guess, and less idealization. That would be my two thoughts.
Well, before my mission, there were plenty of people who tried to give me all sorts of advice, and I discounted it because I was a smart girl, and I had thought about my decision very carefully, and, you know, there was no way I would let some silly little DL make me feel bad because I got home too late, blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, the things people told me of, like, these are the difficulties you will encounter. Yeah, I guess the advice I would give is listen to the advice you get from return missionaries. I got plenty of advice, and I thought I knew better. Especially the advice I would give is that when someone tells you about a difficulty you will have, believe them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so right off the bat, be prepared to give yourself the space to even make a decision about going on a mission, that you don't necessarily have to fall prey to the cultural pressure that you're a worthy, wonderful individual whether you go on a mission or not, and mm-hmm. that there's lots of ways to be good practicing Mormons, right? And mission experience is one way, but it doesn't have to be the way. And and be prepared to listen to advice of other people and hear their experiences. Be prepared for normal human emotion. So it's normal to be sad when you miss your family, right? It's normal to have bad days and good days on a mission. It's normal to feel exhausted or tired or, confused even, or disheartened by things not going the right way. And to your point, Daniel, not necessarily equating that to your worthiness all the time. That there is, I think there's a difference between saying, I'd like to continue to progress and grow as an individual, but that doesn't mean that I somehow need to have already reached some level of perfection that's unattainable anyway.
Yeah.
So those are all good things. And then I think it can be very, powerful and empowering to say, you do have a right to come home.
Yes.
You are an adult.
Agreed. Yeah.
You do not have to stay if somebody is mistreating you or is being abusive in some way or fashion. Or if you know that you need resources, you have a right to request that and to, come home if those needs are not being met, or if you're finding that the missionary experience is not to your benefit, kind of like what you're saying, Holly, right? That thought never even crossed your mind, but maybe it would have been a perfectly reasonable idea for you to say, you know, I've had enough and I've tried and this was what it was and it's part of my journey and I'm going to go home now.
Right.
One
other bit of advice I would give is, make sure before you go that there is at least one person to whom you can write utterly honest, candid letters, mm-hmm. and who won't judge you. Just promise yourself and promise someone that you will always tell the truth about what is happening to you, even if it is only one person. There needs to be someone who knows and who can tell you, okay, what's happening with you isn't what should be happening.
Yeah, I love that. I love that idea. And shifting kind of away from the pre-mission changes to like the actual in the field, I would just say that I think we need to re-examine how much contact is allowed with one's support system. As Holly had so beautifully noted, that the reason she served was in many ways because of the people that she loved and grew up with. And, those missionaries who, as we noted before, are most traumatized because they're the most bought in, I think could greatly, experience reduced mission trauma by just having more access to their support and their encouragement system to bounce off thoughts and create growth out of what left unaddressed would create harm.
Yeah.
And why not even visit the 2-year idea or even the 18-month idea? Why is there a certain time frame that makes a mission either a successful or non-successful return? So couldn't there be an evaluation process of, you know, you've been out for 2 months. How's it going? You know, is this a good fit? Are there other ways you'd prefer to serve rather than on a mission, you know, and have that be an every 4 to 6 month type of reevaluation? So that it's, and change our community culture around that it's just as, successful to serve a 2-week mission as it is a 4-year mission, if you want. I mean, you know, so why the time limits?
Yeah. And even especially like the really big markers, like 6 months, a year. I'm sure that one reason the church is hesitant to do that is because it's very expensive to teach a missionary a foreign language and so forth. But if it's going to happen anyway, why not reduce the shame and the harm? And, I don't think it cements people's loyalty to the church to feel shamed by the church.
Yeah.
So letting them go home with more dignity, I think is probably a really good idea. And will probably reduce, actually it will probably reduce headaches for mission presidents and so forth.
Well, and I've seen a shift too, where some people can come home kind of on temporary basis, like in other words, to work on an issue or, you know, like if they're having certain anxiety or things of that nature. And I think that's very helpful. So in other words, like a sabbatical from your mission in a sense, yeah. As long as it's not tied to some type of shame if you don't return, right? So in other words, look, go home, figure this out, give yourself, you know, 4 to 6 months to kind of reevaluate. And then if you want to return, you've got a space here, you know, and yeah. We'll welcome you back. So I've seen some of that movement, but again, I think it's with a lot of pressure to go back. And again, families, I think sometimes, unfortunately, really feed into this, that what it means to have a successful missionary child has a lot of weight and meaning to whether or not you feel you're a successful parent. And I think that, you know, we all need help kind of reevaluating that way of measuring our parent success.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Yeah.
I remember my MTC companion who I loved dearly throughout my whole mission. We served in the MTC and then went to Jamaica together. Had mentioned that his father told him that it was up to him if he wanted to serve a mission, but that if he went, he needed to follow through because if he quit, he'd be a quitter for the rest of his life. Mm. I was just like, whoa, that's heavy. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that in my experience the church did really well, and unfortunately this is a little bit subject to that leadership roulette, you know, that both Holly and I happen to have great mission presidents, but many missionaries do not, is that it sounds like both of us had access to mental health resources. Unfortunately, those resources are going to be limited by, you know, whatever the state of the mental health system is, wherever you're serving. And in many cases here, we've just spent, you know, almost 2 hours talking about the interpersonal and social and spiritual impacts to serving a mission, and then so often still in the year 2015, the number one answer to resolving the negative effects of all of this is psychotropic medication. And nothing against antidepressants, they have their use, but here we've just discussed very clearly that these are normative reactions to very abnormal life experiences, and to medicate them away could serve to reinforce the trauma.
Well, and I got my prescription, like I said, it was 1986, and Prozac wasn't even on the market then. I hated the antidepressants I was given. They were awful. They gave me horrible nightmares, some really awful side effects. And I had to go to, mental health facilities can be scary. Try a mental health facility in a foreign language, in a foreign country. And I had to drag my poor companion. It was that compounded the trauma. And I was so sick. But like by the end, the cluster of horrible health issues I had, I was constantly going to the doctor, and, you know, at one point they thought maybe I had tumors in my intestines and blah, blah, blah. It was all awful. Yeah. And the fact that there were people who loved me and cared about me and were unhappy to see me suffering didn't mean that they could do anything at all about it. Yeah. And didn't mean that any of the gestures they made helped. Many of them were profoundly harmful. I did love both my mission presidents, but they got a lot of things wrong.
Mm-hmm. And I think that leads to the huge need to really increase the rigorous and robust nature of training mission presidents, in being what they need to be. And instead of a quick, I don't know, what is it, 1 or 2 weeks in the MTC, and then by and large, these mission presidents are just left to their own devices, which really opens up that, as mentioned before, the even unintentional ecclesiastical abuse.
And I also think, I mean, like, the sick RMs kept talking about their mission president's wives, and I also loved both my mission president's wives. They were wonderful, wonderful women. But quite frankly, I know they weren't a spiritual leader. Why would I have gone to them? Why? They couldn't fix anything. They couldn't give me permission to go to the hospital in the other mission. I was not going to go have an interview with them. I mean, I would go talk to them. I was in their ward. I translated a relief society for them. But I mean, I loved them and I hung out with them, but I wasn't going to them for help with my issues. I went to them for just like normal stuff, just to talk to a person in English and not have it be weird, which was, yeah, of course, healing in its own way. But they could not provide the things I really, truly needed. Only a mission president could do that. And yeah, they both of them just didn't know what to do with me.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and I think in different missions, the mission president's wife has different types of authority depending on how that mission is being run. And oftentimes, I think what the SickRM podcast pointed out was that many times it was the wives that were kind of in charge of mental health services or physical health services, and kind of being a resource and figuring out those
I think that actually is a recent development that mm-hmm. they've tried to give them more of a role, and especially as they've realized that there are things that have to be addressed
that are more necessary. Yeah.
Yeah. But within the psyche of a missionary, in terms of the hierarchy that Daniel mentioned and so forth, the mission president's wife is just a substitute. She's always going to be just, you know.
Sad but true.
Yeah, the structure is set up so that she doesn't have final authority, obviously. Yeah. Yeah. So, to your point, Daniel, I think, you know, research shows over and over again that, best treatment outcomes are usually using a combination of psychotropic meds and talk therapy. Mm-hmm. And I think that is widely underused in missionary circles. You know, I mean, I know that in my practice, and oftentimes I'm the only LDS therapist around in a long area. I've seen missionaries on very few occasions, you know, both when I was living in Wisconsin and here in Kansas. So I don't know. I mean, they might be using other resources other than me. I don't know that, but I just don't know that talk therapy is something that is very much promulgated. And I remember even when I did see, you know, the few missionaries that I did see, it was an awkward kind of situation because they'd come with their companion, and mm-hmm. then the companion has to go off and sit somewhere for an hour. And
yeah.
So it's kind of this awkward, you know, weird. I think, I mean, one of the suggestions I would give is you don't need a mental illness to find talk therapy helpful. And yeah. I think it would actually be beneficial for all missionaries to once a week or once every 2 weeks to have a professional that they go and talk some of these issues out with. That can help with relationships. It can help with some of these kind of normative transitional adjustments. And especially if the professional is competent with Mormon culture and understands kind of what this whole system is about.
Yeah.
Instead of just freaking out, like Holly said, and said, what the heck is this? Right? Like, this is totally unhealthy.
There's this balance though, because like when I got home from my mission, I went to LDS Social Services and talked for an hour to just the most condescending, horrible man who said something. He said, "Now I can't solve all your problems." And I said, "Of course you can't. You didn't create them. How could you solve them?" I was so indignant and insulted, and I was like, "This is not going to help me." But then, as I mentioned, you know, one of the reasons I underscored in my introduction that, you know, I was given a prescription for antidepressants from a trio of Freudian atheist psychiatrists. You know, what they wanted to talk to me about was my sex life. I'm like, yeah. I am a suicidally depressed Mormon virgin missionary. Do you think I care about my sex life? What?
That's that importance of cultural competence, right? And also, part of cultural competence is being aware of Mormon issues without projecting your own Mormon bias as a therapist onto your clients. So that's a tricky, whether you're seeing a non-LDS therapist or an LDS therapist, there's potential for cultural competence to be awry in either situation.
Certainly.
All right, so what recommendations would we have to family members or, you know, support systems that missionaries are either coming home to or writing home about, or as we're sending them off, any suggestions to family members or ward communities or leaders that are part of the process of supporting a missionary?
All you need is love, really. I think what it comes down to is, as I'd mentioned before, really reexamining this demand or expectation that missions be served. But, in communications, in expressions of fear and of doubt and expressions of weakness or vulnerability and perceived weakness, missionaries just need a lot of genuine love and support and insight from those that they love. And that, as Holly mentioned before, like, if they decide to come home, then there is no failure in that. There's no demand at the veil that you will have served and completed your 2 years. As far as I know.
Yeah, no, you're right. And maybe staying away from some of these catastrophic statements, like, if you come home, you'll always be a quitter, or it's better that you come home in a pine box than unworthily, or, some of these kind of mythological, folklore that kind of sometimes, depending on the culture you come from in Mormonism, are quite painful things to try to integrate into your experience.
Yeah.
I would also say the love is absolutely, absolutely essential and will cover a huge swath of mistakes. But I would also say encourage honesty. Just tell them, somebody's going to tell you that you can only share positive experiences with me, but you can tell me anything. And in fact, I hope you will. And I won't judge you if you write me a letter on a Tuesday instead of on P day. Tell me, obey the big things, but taking time out of your day to drop me a few lines and let me know when things are bad, that's not something, you can break that rule. I would actually encourage missionaries to break, as they see fit, the interdiction against writing home any day but Peter.
Yeah. And I love that, because one of the greatest tasks of addressing trauma is an individual being able to allow for complex reality and ambiguity within their experience. So we've got to break down this black and white thinking. Mm-hmm. Very beginning of all of that is honesty. Honesty to yourself and being able to just be honest and bare your soul to someone or several people in your support system is exactly how that type of honesty is modeled and experienced.
Right. And not writing back to your missionary, well, just pray harder or study the scriptures harder, or in other words, falling into that same system that somehow there's something wrong with the missionary, that right. There's something wrong, right? So validating their experience, I hear the frustration in your letter, I can understand how this must be difficult. What you're doing is a huge adventure, and at the same time, something that's really life altering, and there's going to be, obviously good and bad things about that. So I totally hear you, those kinds of affirming, validating statements instead of quickly trying to solve the problem in some superficial way that usually is not very helpful.
Yeah.
And also, even if the missionary only writes once a week, parents can write back more than that. Like, honestly, I never got enough mail. I mean, I don't know how it's, if it's different now that people can communicate by email, or if missionaries only get, I've heard that some places they can only check the email on Monday or whatever, but it wasn't just, it was that I didn't hear from my family often enough. You know, I never got enough mail. Care packages. I mean, that's the best name for them. They show you care. Send people stuff.
Yeah,
that's great. What recommendations would we have? We've mentioned a few as far as structural changes, you know, could we change the time limits? Could we change, you know, offer more talk therapy? Could we have mindfulness trainings? Could we, any other structural ideas or suggestions that, you know, as you think through, how we approach the missionary experience, that we could maybe shift our traditions or our ways of doing things?
I think that once a month, missionaries need an extra P day. That's just or maybe the 31st of every month is you have off. Missionaries need a little more time to just sanction time to just recuperate. And then also, I really think the church should move to make all missions largely service.
Yeah, I would largely echo that. I do love that. You know, my sister-in-law and my brother-in-law, who have both served or are serving since I've been back, I'm very over the moon to hear that tracting, you know, knocking doors, or in my case in Jamaica, knocking gates, was really non-existent in their missions. And so I'm excited to hear that that's the case for them. I hope that that's something that becomes more of a reality, because there are a few things more miserable than waking up in the morning as a missionary to an empty schedule, knowing that you'll be walking in 100-degree heat with 90% humidity, just shouting at people's gates, and who knows what's going to happen for the next 14 hours of the day. So I'm glad that that shift has happened in some missions. I hope that it happens in more. I think orienting missions more towards service would yield so many benefits, both for the individual missionaries and for the church. And then apart from that, just the structure of allowing for more contact with the missionary support system, with their family and loved ones. I don't believe that would reduce focus, as the kind of dogmatic fear is. I think it would increase motivation and normalization of hard things.
I agree. And especially the completely open schedule. I mean, that only happened to me a few times, but it really is devastating. And especially because there's this disconnect. You're told that this is the most important time of your life, but it feels like an utter waste of time and sheer drudgery.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really, really hard.
I wish I could say that an empty schedule only happened a couple times on my mission. That was,
again,
was more the norm.
No, we had, I was lucky. I really was. We, most of the time we managed to stay busy. But that's, I think, probably easier for sisters, since there are fewer of them, and since women tend to be more interested in religion, sister missionaries are just going to have more people to teach.
Yeah.
So that's another thing, actually. I mean, if you ever want to do this again, Natasha, we could spend a very long time talking about gender issues on missions.
Oh, sure.
You're here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I barely touched on that, but it's a huge can of worms. And finding ways to treat sister missionaries with more respect. I have heard of some. I've heard that there are like districts for sisters, that districts can be basic, that sisters can be district leaders, or the equivalent or something.
Yes, I think of other sisters. Yes, there has been some shift in that regard. Yeah. Yes.
And then also just, like, teaching elders that, like, actually, you know what? Just don't boss the sisters around. they don't need you to tell them when to go to bed.
Right. So I guess my last questions, and then we can have closing thoughts, but my last question would be about, you know, you mentioned, Holly, how you were listening to the Sick RMs podcast and that there was some triggering there happening for you even, you know, so many years later. What kind of resources or suggestions can we give to those who, you know, are maybe listening to this and are saying, yeah, you know, I was traumatized, or I've known that, or now I'm realizing that, or I'm having some, you know, triggering effects from listening to some of this. What are some things that we can suggest as far as how to start healing and getting help for yourself in this regard?
You know, I wish I had more answers to that. The few answers that I do have, thoughts about that, is that to continue to, I think we've got to build this communities like Sick RMs, where missionaries can, share their experience. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole basis of narrative therapy and being able to process things, and not necessarily become reactive to it. That said, you know, I'm here in northern Utah and see missionaries, whether they be returned a month or several dozen years, to be able to process that trauma and those frustrations and that disintegration of identity and how that snowballed into other areas of life. I do think that we need more comprehensive, I think a more robust community will lead to more comprehensive lists of professionals that specialize in this. I know that Mormon Mental Health Association and their list of providers often specifically notes providers that address, you know, spiritual conflict and issues. And then I'm going to throw out a shameless plug for my book, because again, I think we just need a more honest dialogue about this. And that's the whole reason that I wrote it, and hope that people will read it and be able to say, you know, I think we can talk about the strengths and blessings of serving a mission in tandem with the costs and the trauma.
And I'll definitely link to that.
Mm-hmm. Those are really good. I mean, you know, the sad truth is I just cobbled together, there were no resources, and I had to beg and fight. I had to beg my mother to let me go to therapy. After my mission, I was in such a bad way. I said, Mom, if you don't get me therapy, I will die. And she, told me to stop being so histrionic, but she did eventually help me find a therapist who I am not being hyperbolic when I say that woman saved my life. And no one could hear me. I guess I would recommend some books. I really liked, Through the Narrow Gate by Karen Armstrong, which is about a woman at about the same time of her life. She's 17 years old when she joins a cloistered convent in the UK in 1962 and comes out in 1969 having missed the Beatles and having, spoiler alert, having developed epilepsy while she was in the convent and been shamed for that and told it was just her weak will. I would also recommend The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien, which is about combat in Vietnam. Like, honestly, that's the main, you know, I got a PhD in English Lit. That's how I dealt with my mission trauma. I don't really recommend it. It's expensive and not all that effective. But the way I guess I would say I read books that helped me make sense. So kind of, you know, another form of narrative therapy basically is what I'm recommending. So,
yeah. And I would hope that the main message that anybody listening to this can get tonight is that we're validating your experience, you know, this, that you're not alone, that many, many people have had similar traumatic events on missions. It doesn't necessarily mean that your mission was all bad or all good. Again, that's kind of black and white. Usually missions are a complicated assortment of experiences that fall under both of those categories. There's nothing to be ashamed of, if you're feeling negative, emotions or, even triggers around missionary experience. And it really has nothing, in my opinion, to do with your worth or your worthiness level or how good of a Mormon you are or anything along those lines. So I just want to offer that validation and then encourage people to, as you've both mentioned, you know, there's a lot of good people who do great therapy. And if you start with a therapist and start that process and start feeling uncomfortable or shamed or that they're not understanding where you're coming from, then it's time to switch. Sometimes it takes two or three times before you find a good match. Yes, and, yeah. And you mentioned Mormon Mental Health Association. I'm working hard to try to make a good referral list there of people all over the country. We're just kind of in the beginnings of that. So there's not necessarily resources everywhere, but some people are also willing to do like online consultations and things like that. If you don't necessarily live by somebody who might be culturally competent to do that work. There are great non-LDS professionals who, although you may have to spend a little bit of time explaining the system, will do great work with you. So, yeah. It's not necessarily that you have to see an LDS or an LDS, informed person to do good work. And, journaling can be very helpful. Talking to other people or finding a community. I think Sick RMs is trying to fill that role. I know that Chris Doty out of Utah, I'm going to mess it up because when I was there, it was UVSC. Now it's Utah State University.
Utah Valley University.
Thank you.
I Googled her. It's KRISDOTY because yes. I had trouble tracking her down. But yes, I did that after hearing that podcast. She's absolutely, her work seems really interesting.
Yeah. So she's doing, a lot of research kind of based stuff, which, again, helps, you know, we need professionals who are doing research so that then we can have education, so that then we can have treatment protocols, you know, so many of those things are related to people who are doing research. Daniel, I will definitely link to your book. There's definitely things out there, even though I think this is still a pretty taboo and not talked about subject, there's definitely things that you can start doing to improve the quality of your life and start changing the framing of what might be a really negative way that you're perceiving how this all went down.
And yeah. I guess this is one thing, for many years, even running into the elders would give me a panic attack. Mm-hmm. So just give yourself, just be really nice to the missionaries when they come to your door, but don't let them in.
Yeah.
Just offer them a glass of water and say, I can't let you in. Cause you don't have to do that. And, as somebody who was a missionary, you know what it's like to be turned down, and you can do it politely, but you did your stint. You don't have to interact with the missionaries anymore if you don't want to.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a kind of a boundary thing, right? Is figuring out your own boundaries and what's safe and what isn't safe for you. Yeah. Well, I'd like to kind of just give you both an opportunity for closing thoughts, statements, anything I haven't covered or that you wanted to make sure we covered tonight that we haven't yet. So why don't you both take a shot at that?
I guess what I would say, my mission was profoundly traumatic and it left me with PTSD. That doesn't change the fact that I actually really loved many of the people I worked with. I did leave the church. But it's been this thing that people sometimes don't understand that I still feel enormous affection for many of the missionaries I worked with. I am actually grateful when any of them are willing to still be my friend. I am Facebook friends with several of my companions. A lot of them, you know, don't know what to make of me or don't really have anything to say to me since I don't go to church anymore. But you know, I actually would be really happy if anybody would be willing to process some mission stuff with me. I actually did get a phone call about a year ago from a companion, from my least favorite companion. She looked me up online. That was both very good and very weird. But you know, that's one of those things with trauma, that it's still something that's part of your life. And so ways to process it and make it less scary and draw anything redeeming from it is useful. And, you know, it's one of those things. It's not even worth my time to imagine what my life would be like if I hadn't gone. I did go. I went on a mission. It unmade me as a human being, and then I got to make myself back. And that's just how it is.
I love that, Holly. I love that, just knowing that it's a waste of time to think about having not gone or what it would be like. And I would echo that sentiment. You know, and I think this has been a great discussion, about the reality of mission related trauma. And the only thing I would add is that, you know, we as a culture, as a church, as people, we need to acknowledge and address this, not because we're trying to rail against the church, but because we love the gospel and love the church. You know, I personally, I don't really buy into the don't study the ark school of thought when it comes to the church. You know, the LDS church was started, it all started with a boy asking questions, and then almost the entirety of the Doctrine and Covenants is the result of members of the church advocating and asking questions and taking issues to the prophet Joseph for guidance and resolution. And so I just would really highlight that we've got to address this because we want to do a better job of becoming saints and of becoming a community, of approaching Zion. And, that's my closing thought.
Well, I love that. I thank you both very much for all of your thoughts and ideas and suggestions. And I think this has been very powerful. I guess my closing thought would be that this sacrifice of, you know, committing any part of your life to your religion, even if it's just an intent, in other words, you wanted to go and for whatever reason weren't able to, should be acknowledged and really, celebrated and seen for what it is, as a sacrifice of love. And I think that we all need to do a better job of, regardless of how that ends up looking like, that's a worthy cause, you know, and that's a worthy, I don't know. It's just, it's something that you're laying on the altar, you know, and it may not look like you thought it should, or, whatever ways that you may have issues with that, but it's something that's, I think, very speaks to, I think, something that Mormons are very good at, which kind of comes back to that usefulness, and we're, you know, we just, in many ways are very good people, and wanting to give back and wanting to, you know, offer of our services and our talents to this gospel that we love and the church that we are so committed to. So that's something to be honored, and we need to honor all, you know, all, whatever that looks like for every individual.
Yeah.
Can I just make a comment here?
Yeah.
I actually said on my mission in my journal that I felt that I had laid my most precious gifts on the altar, and they had been flung back in my face and told that they were garbage. And I felt I had nothing left to give and nothing left to be. And so I would just really agree with that that when someone makes a sacrifice, that when someone says, this is the best I have to give, we have to say thank you. We have to say that is worthy. It is unimaginably cruel to do anything else.
Mm. Yeah, thank you for that, Holly. I agree. Well, in that spirit of honoring all those who have gone before us, we'll close the podcast. And I would just, again, thank you both so much for your time. And I mean, we've been here over 2 hours, which is longer than what I normally do. And I really appreciate, your willingness to give of your time and energies towards this very important topic. I would also just mention to the listenership, that we are looking for donations. We need support to keep this podcast afloat. There's costs associated with this podcast that are currently not being covered. And I would just appreciate anyone's, ability to help in that regard. So you can make donations off the website at mormonmentalhealth.org. And we'll continue to try to bring good content and good topics that many of us are addressing either in our personal lives or in those in our family or ward communities. So I just really feel strongly about the mission statement of this podcast. Thank you again for coming, and I wish you both a good night.
Good night, Natasha. Thank you.
Good night. Yes, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Over last tempestuous sea, charred and calm, came from thee, Jesus Savior, pilot me, unknown ways before me roll, hiding rock, and treacherous shore. Chart and compass came from thee, Jesus Savior, pilot me. Say to me,
'twixt me and the peaceful rest.
The peaceful rest.
Then while leaning on my breast, may I hear thee say to me, fear not I.